It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
An explosion in Nigeria's capital takes more than 70 lives. Guinea's foreign minister says the Ebola outbreak there is under control. I'm Victor Behe reporting from Washington. An apparent car bomb at a Nigerian bus station killed at least 71 people Monday, wounding more than 120. The news agency of Nigeria quotes a survivor saying the blast came from a vehicle parked in front of several buses filled with passengers. The man who said he was in one of the buses said the driver of the car parked quickly, disappeared shortly after the explosion. A police spokesman said some 40 vehicles were damaged or destroyed. More now from reporter Heather Murdoch.
Shortly before 7 a.m. Monday morning, taxi driver Joseph Suleiman was driving into the city for work. He was about a half a kilometer from Nyanya Motor Park when the bomb exploded.
We were inside the car. We heard the bomb blast, and my car was shaking. Everybody, we were totally confused.
They were confused, he says, because there hasn't been an attack in the Nigerian capital in 2 years, when Boko Haram blew up a prominent media house, killing several people. In 2011, more than 60 people were killed in other attacks that targeted the local UN headquarters and a church. Some officials say despite nearly a year of emergency rule in 3 northeastern Nigerian states, the Boko Haram insurgency is growing. Boko Haram has been blamed for thousands of deaths since the insurgency began in 2009. Amnesty International says 1,500 people have been killed in attacks this year alone, and about 500,000 people have fled their homes. Boko Haram says it wants to enforce its harsh version of Islamic law and destroy the government, but many analysts blame the unrest partially on extreme poverty, saying unemployment drives young men to fight for small sums of money. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
A U.S. spokesperson in Washington condemned Monday's bombing as a senseless act of violence against innocent civilians. She also condemned a series of attacks on 3 villages in Borno State that killed nearly 100 others. In Egypt, a student was killed Monday in clashes between police and Muslim Brotherhood supporters at Cairo University. Security forces fired tear gas at protesters who hurled fireworks and at least 2 gasoline bombs at police lines. Amid a security crackdown on dissent, universities have become a focal point for protests by supporters of ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi. Meanwhile, former Armed Forces Chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi Monday took the final formal step to run in next month's presidential election. In a statement, his campaign said his supporters submitted to the Election Commission 8 times the number of required signatures to be a candidate. His likely chief rival will be leftist politician Hamdine Sabahi, who finished a strong 3rd in the last presidential ballot, June of 2012. The Associated Press reports Gambian authorities have informed 4 airlines they'll not be allowed to pick up passengers to fly to the West African country from Guinea, Liberia, or Sierra Leone. Although not mentioning the Ebola virus outbreak by name, the countries identified have been grappling with a deadly disease that's taken more than 100 lives in the past 3 months. Meanwhile, Guinea's foreign minister, Francois Fall, Monday said his country, the epicenter of the outbreak, has brought the disease under control with the help of the international community. And after a holiday break, schools reopened Monday in Conakry with new instructors on giving instruction on preventing the spread of Ebola. Teacher Isiaga Bangura said students must respect the rules at school, but also at home. Before eating, they must wash their hands and use bleach at every moment before and after eating. To date, nearly 160 suspected Ebola cases have been identified in Guinea. Officials in Guinea-Bissau say nearly 3/4 of eligible voters turned out for the country's presidential and parliamentary elections on Sunday, hoping it will turn the page on the country's unstable past. The ballot was the first in the country in 2 years since a military coup. Officials hope to publish results as early as Wednesday. The former Portuguese colony has seen 4 decades of chaos marked by mutinies, corruption, and drugs, contributing to widespread poverty in a land of 1.6 million. ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, has called for an end to international sanctions, including travel bans and asset freezes. Human Rights Watch Monday urged the UN Security Council to direct UN peacekeepers in Western Sahara to monitor human rights after accusing Morocco of suppressing dissent in the territory. The council is set to vote next week on renewing the mandate of the peacekeeping mission known as MINURSCO. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. Many of the stories you've heard can also be found and read online at our website, voanews.com.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 15th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan vows to end terrorism after an apparent car bomb killed more than 70 people in Abuja.
The president immediately expressed his condolences to the affected families, and he directed the medical services to ensure that everything is done to make sure that those who were injured receive good medical care.
Ruben Abate is the advisor to Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. Libya's interim prime minister resigns following an attack on him and his family. Zimbabweans weigh in on President Mugabe's leadership as the country marks 34 years of independence this week. And a Rwandan opposition leader accuses the Kagame government of false accusations and arrests.
Every finger seems to point to the fact that some of these actions, if not all of them, are perpetrated by members of security agents of the state so as to find a pretext for crackdown.
Theogene Rudasingwa is coordinator of the opposition Rwanda National Congress. The U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan will give details on the threat of sanctions on South Sudan, rebel and government leaders, and a new drug promises to eradicate hepatitis C. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria state security organizations have launched a joint investigation into Monday's bombings in Nyanya, a suburb of the capital Abuja, that left at least 71 people dead and many injured. Ruben Abate, an advisor to President Goodluck Jonathan, says Mr. Jonathan condemned the bombing after expressing his condolences to the families of the victims. Abate tells reporter Peter Clotty that President Jonathan has promised Nigerians that his administration is determined to end violence perpetrated by terrorist groups.
The president immediately heard what happened, condemned it. He expressed his condolences to the affected families, and he directed the medical services to ensure that everything is done to make sure that those who were injured receive good medical care. And also, he followed up on that by visiting the scene of the bomb blast at the place called Nyanya, where he again addressed the press and reassured Nigerians that the government remains determined to put an end to the scourge of terrorism, and that he is very optimistic that at the end of the day, Nigerians will get over this particular problem. He also used the opportunity to appeal to the media to continue to enlighten the people about the threat of terrorism and the need for vigilance and the need for personal security initiatives.
Security has been bolstered or heightened in and around the capital, Nigeria, and other parts of the country following this bombing. What can you tell me about that?
Well, that was one of the steps that the president took in the morning, and that was clearly indicated in the four tweets that I sent out early in the day, that the president had ordered that security should be heightened in and around Abuja and across the country. Because the place where the bombing took place, Nyanya, is just about 4 kilometers from the federal capital territory. So you could say that it's actually within, you know, almost within Abuja. And many of the people who work within the federal capital territory live in that area.
Has investigations begun following this explosion in Nyanya, a suburb of the capital Abuja?
Of course, the investigations are continuing, and it's an interagency collaborative effort. All the various security agencies are involved, and also the various intelligence agencies of the military.
Ruben Abate is advisor to Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. Meanwhile, the spokesman for Nigeria's ruling People's Democratic Party, the PDP, has called on Nigerians to unite behind President Goodluck Jonathan to end terrorism in the country. Abdullahi Jallo tells reporter Peter Clotty that the international community should help the government in Abuja in its bid to defeat terrorism in the country.
It is just like an attack in Nigeria, as of what has happened. And definitely there is a need for the Western communities to quickly assist Nigeria so that this terrorism will be defeated. We have to commiserate with the other Nigerians that lost their loved ones, and then at the same time, to call upon all Nigerians to stand up against these people. Because if you are terrorizing, you said you are a Boko Haram. and you are killing people, whom are you going to rule? The Western education is part of us. So there is no real purpose in doing this because they cannot get what they want.
How are you reaching out to other political parties and other Nigerians to join in this fight against terrorism that you talked about?
Look, that is Peter, the most unfortunate in Nigeria. When you are a leader, everyone, if something happens, instead of joining hands, everyone will start throwing accusations against you. Because of these nefarious acts of other unpatriotic citizens as an issue of campaign. And it shouldn't be so.
Abdullahi Jallo is spokesman for Nigeria's ruling People's Democratic Party, the PDP. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. A leading Rwandan exile opposition leader has dismissed with contempt an announcement by Rwandan police that they have arrested three people on charges of threatening state security and involvement in planning a violent overthrow of the Kagame government. The three arrested include a radio journalist and a famous peace activist musician. They are accused of having links with the Rwanda National Congress. But Theogene Rudasingwa, former Rwandan ambassador to the United States and now coordinator of the exiled Rwanda National Congress, says, on the contrary, terrorist activities are the hallmark of President Paul Kagame's government. Rudasingwa tells me the allegations are perpetrated by agents of the government to find pretext to crack down on the opposition.
First of all, that absolutely nothing surprising about that. That has been the pattern of the behavior of the government in Kigali. These are not the first ones or the last ones to be arrested. And in fact, being arrested is not the worst that could happen to an individual who has a dissenting voice in Rwanda. There are others who have been killed. There are others who have been languishing in jail for a while. So
the police said that they are suspected to be working closely with senior members of the Rwanda National Congress and the FDLR. Are you saying this is not true?
No, absolutely untrue. And in fact, the musician himself has been somebody who's been working with the government, at least with regard to the efforts toward peace and reconciliation within Rwanda. So I'm only surprised that this kind of events, because there is nothing that I know of that shows that these three gentlemen have been working closely with the senior leadership of organization. But if they are members of the Rwanda National Congress, I wouldn't be surprised, because the majority of the Rwandans certainly do not support this government, and they support our organization, they support other opposition groups. But certainly the opposition is not allowed to operate within Rwanda. We do operate from outside. As for the rest of the population in Rwanda, can only live in silence and in fear, but certainly they don't support the government.
What do you make of the allegations by the police that they have ample evidence, including grenades and testimonies obtained from other accomplices?
Let me tell you one thing. For the last 3 years, if I can remember correctly, since 2010, this story about grenades has come time and time again. And every time it comes up, the government, of course, has been very quick to mention that members of organization, leaders within our organization and our organization as such is an accomplice, first for working with the armed group in Congo, the FDLR, and number two, for throwing the grenades. But we are always surprised that it has not been able actually to substantiate this allegation. To the best of my knowledge, there's nothing that they have shown so far that actually prove that our organization in general, or members, leadership of organization in particular, have been involved in these grenade attacks. And in fact, every finger seems to point to the fact that some of these actions, if not all of them, are perpetrated by members, security agents of the state, so as to find pretext for crackdown that includes some of the leading opposition figures who are in jail.
Theogene Rudasingwa is coordinator of the Rwanda National Congress, one of the exiled Rwandan opposition groups. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 15th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Libya's interim prime minister, Abdullah Al-Thani, who has held the post for less than 3 weeks, has excused himself from forming a new government after he and his family came under attack at their home on Saturday. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Libyan interim prime minister Abdullah Athni announced Sunday that he is effectively giving up his post, adding an extra level of uncertainty to an already unsettled political situation. Mr. Athni said in a statement on the government's website that he would not head the next cabinet, but would stay on in a caretaker capacity until the new government is in place. He said he made the move to protect the interests of the country and avoid dragging different sides into a conflict in which everyone would lose. Government spokesman Ahmed Al-Amin indicated that Mr. Thani was not stepping down immediately, but an attack on his family had prompted him to seek a successor.
لم يتقدم السيد عبد الله ثني باستقالته.
He says Mr. Thni has not resigned but has excused himself from forming the new government. The prime minister and his family, he added, came under attack by a group of armed militiamen at their home late Saturday. Tripoli City Council head Sadat al-Badri condemned the attack against the interim prime minister, calling it a desperate attempt to destabilize the country. He also demanded armed militias evacuate Libyan cities and return them to the people. Former Prime Minister Ali Zeidan, who was given a vote of no confidence on March 11th, was briefly kidnapped by militiamen earlier this year. The Corinthia Hotel, which has served as a residence for various government officials, also came under attack several times. University of Tripoli political science professor Ahmed Al-Atrash tells VOA that he is not expecting any major political disruption from Mr. Thani's stepping down.
A minister from the same cabinet may continue until the election for the next 3-4 months. Taking into account the agreement among the council members and the interim government.
He added that the Libyan public is expecting fresh elections for a new parliament in the months to come, so the current state of change will be taken in stride by most people. Meanwhile, the trial of former leader Muammar Gaddafi's two sons and several former prime ministers got underway briefly in the capital, Tripoli, but was quickly adjourned until April 27th. Investigators say they need more time to finish their cases. Neither of Gaddafi's sons was present at the trial session. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan says the executive order signed by President Barack Obama earlier this month is meant to punish individuals who obstruct the ongoing South Sudan peace process in Addis Ababa and who are violating human rights. Donna Booth says both parties to the conflict must show leadership and commitment towards peace to avoid being on this U.S. sanctions list.
I have been warning, even since January, I made this statement at the IGAD summit at the end of January, that there would be consequences for those who continue to obstruct the peace process. I made that warning again in Addis last month. And so the executive order should not have come as a surprise to anyone. The United States has made clear its intent to focus on those individuals who commit gross violations of human rights, who obstruct the peace process, who circumvent the cessation of hostilities agreement. We are looking at who we might designate, but we really want to use the executive order as a warning to those who are obstructing the peace process that that behavior needs to change. And so we have not actually sanctioned any individual yet, but as I have continually warned, for those who continue to obstruct the peace process, we will take action. So I think we should look at this executive order really as an incentive, a carrot, if you will, to those who are trying to do the right thing. This gives them, I think, some additional room maneuver. It gives them some leverage over those who would obstruct trying to move forward in honoring the cessation of hostilities agreement, in moving forward the peace process, moving forward a true political negotiation, a true political process that will begin to address the underlying problems that South Sudan has faced.
A lot of analysts in the region are a little bit wondering, why is U.S. all of a sudden very harsh towards South Sudan? What are the reasons behind this new development?
As I've mentioned, we're looking at those people who, through their actions, are harming the people of South Sudan, through their actions, are frustrating the peace process, through their actions, are encouraging the continuation of fighting. Those are the people that we're trying to influence through this executive order. Those are the people who need to change their behavior and to help the people of South Sudan achieve the peace that they've so long struggled for.
Ambassador Donald Booth is the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. He was speaking with John Tanza of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program. Zimbabwe will this week mark 34 years of independence from colonial rule amid concerns from many citizens that President Robert Mugabe is using the suppression of the people's will to extend his rule. Thomas Tiripasi of VOA Zimbabwe program takes a look at how President Mugabe has fared since he took over power from Ian Smith in 1980.
When President Mugabe assumed the office in 1980, many Zimbabweans believed the country would literally overflow with milk and honey, as promised by the Zandla and Zipra guerrilla fighters during the struggle for independence. 34 years down the line, many Zimbabweans, such as God knows Shumba, say that life is becoming more and more difficult under Mr. Mugabe's stewardship. Shumba says the electorate has long decided to vote Mr. Mugabe out of power, but claims the nonagenarian leader has been using an iron fist to suppress the will of the majority during elections.
We know already that the ZANU-PF government is putting in place a lot of machinery. As Zimbabweans, we cannot rise against the government because we are afraid of the Zimbabwean government.
Democratic Party President Uriah Zembe says Mr. Mugabe's biggest undoing of his legacy was the militarization of elections. The Zimbabwean leader has since early 2000 accused the opposition and non-governmental organizations of being agents of what he calls illegal regime change.
Mugabe has actually received much more funding from foreign countries than any one of us in this country. It's totally cheap propaganda. The facts are there.
MDCT National Organizing Secretary Nelson Chamisa says the big man mentality has led Mr. Mugabe to abandon democratic processes, resulting in dictatorial tendencies.
Mr. Mugabe has been able to succeed himself because there's not been any willing successor or any successor with the capacity to tackle issues of leadership head-on. It's a crisis of the big man syndrome.
Meanwhile, Zembe said the opposition has been failing to take over power from Mr. Mugabe because it remains fragmented.
The problem in Zimbabwe is that no one wants to be led. Everyone wants to be president. And in that scenario, it is very difficult for the opposition to forge an effective front that can dislodge ZANU-PF from power.
Efforts to get a comment from ZANU-PF spokesperson Rugare Gumbo failed, but social commentator and former MDC legislator Gabriel Chaiva, who crossed the floor to join ZANU-PF, told Studio 7 by phone from Harare that the economic situation should not deter Zimbabweans from celebrating the gains of the liberation struggle. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Doctors who treat hepatitis C are hailing the development of drugs that can effectively eradicate the infection, which is a leading cause of cirrhosis and liver cancers worldwide. At the same time, their focus now has turned to reducing the high cost of treatment so that it is accessible to developing countries where 80% of people are infected. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
An estimated 150 to 185 million people worldwide are infected with hepatitis C, and many don't know it. That's because the virus is largely silent until late symptoms appear, including grinding fatigue, joint pain, abdominal pain, and jaundice, a yellowing of the skin and eyes. But pivotal studies of new antiviral drugs conducted in developed countries show they knock out upwards of 90% of hepatitis C infections, promising to revolutionize treatment in low- and middle-income countries. Chana Jasekra is with the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at Stanford University in California. Jasekra spoke via Skype from the International Liver Conference meeting in London, where the new treatment options for hepatitis C are getting a lot of attention.
This is really a landmark achievement in all of medicine, I would say, because it's one of the few times where we've been able to definitively eradicate a disease with a short course of oral therapy.
Experts say the oral medications may even be more effective in the developing world because people there harbor different, possibly more responsive types of the virus than in the West. But a three-month course of the second-generation antiviral drugs in the West costs between $85,000 and $90,000, according to Jasekra. However, with the issuance of guidelines by the World Health Organization for the diagnosis and treatment of hepatitis C with oral medications in low- and moderate-income countries, there are moves to bring down the cost. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sports here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with athletics. Kenya's first lady, Margaret Kenyatta, is the first spouse of a sitting head of state anywhere in the world to complete a marathon race. Kenyatta took 7 hours to complete the London Marathon in the British capital on Sunday. Trained by Kenya's 1987 World Marathon champion Douglas Wakihuri, Kenyatta completed the marathon as part of her charity fundraising project aimed at improving maternity care facilities in Kenya's 47 counties. Staying in London, world record holder Wilson Kipsang set a course record of 2 hours, 4 minutes and 29 seconds in the men's race to finish ahead of fellow Kenyan Stanley Biwott and third-placed Ethiopian defending champion Tsegaye Kebede. In the women's contest, world champion Edna Kiplagat pipped fellow Kenyan Florence Kiplagat in the sprint for the finish line to claim the women's title, while Ethiopian marathon debutant Tirunish Dibaba placed third. Elsewhere, Kenyan Eliud Kipchoge and Ethiopian Abebech Asewok won the men's and women's races at the Rotterdam Marathon in the Netherlands, while Ethiopian Getu Feleke prevailed in the Vienna Marathon in Austria. Turning to football, Libya is jointly with El Salvador, Kazakhstan, Moldova and Vietnam the most improved national teams in the world, while Liberia has slipped by the widest margins, according to the latest FIFA rankings released in Zurich, Switzerland. The Elephants of Ivory Coast are Africa's highest ranked team in 21st place. Egypt is 24th, Algeria 25th, Ghana 38th, Cape Verde Islands 42nd, and African champions Nigeria 45th. Tunisia is 49th, Cameroon 50th, Guinea 51st, and Mali 59th. Meanwhile, hosts Mauritania pipped Mauritius 1-0 in the opening round of their 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations preliminaries in Nouakchott over the weekend. Elsewhere, South Africa fought hard from a 2-0 deficit to hold their Zimbabwean visitors to a 2-2 draw in a women's football friendly in Soweto. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, Jane, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, April 15th.
I wish to congratulate the MTN mobile telephone network in Nigeria for a noble decision to introduce solar mobile electricity for its customers. Let them speed up and do it so that we shall put an end to the eclectic and disappointing electricity in Nigeria. Thank you, Anushia. Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. And that's it for this Tuesday, April 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing everybody a very good day. VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight,
we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.